Hi, this is The Takeaway from Monday, October 23rd, 2017.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. Thank you for being here with us today. The most destructive wildfires in Northern California history are now almost completely contained. That's according to state fire officials. Residents are slowly returning to their neighborhoods, many finding homes completely destroyed, and others reckoning with damage that will take a lot of time and a lot of money to repair.
It's like you've been kicked in the stomach repeatedly. Yeah, it's just really hard. You know, digging through, hoping to find some little memento.
Family, heirlooms, pictures, anything really that's kind of worth the sentimental value, I guess, is the main thing. But it doesn't look like we're finding too much right now.
It's heartbreaking, you know. It's everything I had. No, it's gone.
It's just awful. And it's horrible that it's not just us, it's everybody, you know. Like, if you look around the whole neighborhood, everybody's house is gone.
No, I guess there's a reason people buy fireproof safes.
Well, amid all this chaos, normalcy and routine can be hard to come by. Well, some small amount of normalcy should return this week for students. The Santa Rosa City School District is set to open about half of its 24 schools after extensive cleanups. More than 16,000 students have been out of classes since October 8th. And as they return to school now, both students and teachers are relying on support systems to help deal with the devastation and disruption of lost homes. Diane Kitamura is superintendent of Santa Rosa City Schools. Diane, thanks for being here.
Well, thank you for having me. I greatly appreciate it.
Give me a sense of the scope of the disaster and the destruction in your community. How many students, how many faculty, teachers have lost homes?
So, yes, of the 16,000 students, what we know is approximately 900 students live within the fire zones, and 79 staff members also live within the fire zones. We know that for the staff members, 77 of those 79 have actually lost their homes. Two of the 79 have extensive damage. Again, of the 900 students, we are not exactly sure because we still have not made contact with some of those 900 students.
I mean, it's an unbelievable amount of damage affecting so many of your students and faculty. What about your schools themselves, the physical structures? Many of them were in the fire zone, I imagine. How much damage did you sustain there?
So we had one school completely burned to the ground. There's just a shell of a frame left. We have a school laboratory farm. As you know, we're in the heart of agriculture and wine growing. And so we had a full winery, wine grape school farm where the structures there also burned down. Every single one of our schools sustained some sort of fire-related damage, whether it was soot, smoke, because the fires were all around the entire school district.
So, Diane, let's talk about the students themselves as they return to class here. What have you been hearing from parents and from the students? It would seem like they're eager, as I said, to get back to some regular routine, some sense of normalcy. Is that going to be possible for everyone?
You know, it is. It's such a balance that we walk. We have some, again, as I said, some homes were affected far more than others. Some schools affected far more than others. And so for those that have been highly affected, which really is a lot, is many, many, many of our students, there is this trepidation. I want to get back to normalcy, as you say, but I'm also fearful. I'm also a bit traumatized by what has happened. And so what we're doing is we're ensuring that as students and staff return, we're putting in we're having strong support systems begin to welcome and help faculty and students as they return back to school.
Counseling, availability of someone to talk to?
That's right. What we've done is this week, as schools were being remediated or clean, we've also brought teams together of counselors, school psychologists, county mental health, city agencies, volunteer agencies, other school districts, providing some of their resources, training specifically for talking with faculty and students about the trauma of the fires.
Diane, this is a huge disruption just to the school year itself. Is school going to have to go later this year or longer days to make up the lost time in class?
That's an excellent question. The governor and the state superintendent have worked together in California to do what they call average daily attendance protection. And what that means is, because this is a disaster, these days don't legally have to be made up.
So that might be a big help to parents and students as well. They can still have a summer vacation.
Right, right. And, you know, again, that's that balance between students missing school and then how is it that we make up that instruction. Mm-hmm. And my answer to that is that these 2 weeks have probably been some of the most intense teaching and learning our children can ever, ever have.
Well, students and faculty have been through so much in your school district, Diane. What's coming up? I don't know if homecoming was possible this year, if you're going to be able to make that up, or if there's anything else exciting on the school calendar that people can look forward to.
So, you know, we did have to, postpone homecoming because the air quality was such that our athletes couldn't even practice. But the good news is that for Santa Rosa City Schools, practices will begin this week. One of the reasons practices was held off is we actually had to clean our turf. It had to be cleaned after the fires. And so now the air quality is much better. And so now our athletes will be able to get back onto the fields and onto the courts, which will then allow for all those other activities to take place, such as homecoming.
Well, we're happy to hear that the football team, the track team, the basketball team is going to get back on the field and the courts after some real devastation in your community. Diane Kitamura, superintendent for Santa Rosa City Schools, thank you for being with us.
Thank you very much.
As many as 500,000 people took to the streets in Catalonia over the weekend after Spain's prime minister announced new measures cracking down on the region's bid for independence. Spanish Prime Minister Mariano Rajoy announced over the weekend that he would invoke Article 155 of the Spanish Constitution and take direct rule over Catalonia. He also said he would use that power to replace Catalonia's democratically elected government. Earlier this month, Spanish National Police disrupted polling places during Catalonia's independence referendum, and there were violent clashes with voters and demonstrators. Becker Seguin is assistant professor of Iberian Studies at Johns Hopkins University. Professor, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
What does this latest move from Madrid mean?
So Article 155, as you mentioned, allows the central government to take over complete control of Catalan institutions. This includes the police force, because so Catalonia has a police force called the Mossos, which are independent from the National Guard and the National Police. It includes the TV station, so Catalan National TV, TV3, and also taxes and basic kind of functions, such as trains and transportation. And what Rajoy did on Saturday was he effectively used the entire extent of the law, the Article 155 of the Spanish Constitution. And people, I think, were at least a little bit surprised that he used its full extent, because many people think that that wasn't necessary, that he could have displaced a few ministers, he could have announced a new parliamentary elections, and that would have been enough, because it seems like that is his end goal. But instead, he decided to take the entire powers afforded to him by Article 155 of the Constitution and effectively threaten the state of Catalonia with an entire and complete control by the central government.
So what is the threat here, Becker? What's supposed to happen? If you work for the railways in Barcelona, or you work for the television station or some other institution, they come in and say, you work for Spain now, or are we expecting purges in these bureaucracies?
So that's the idea. The idea is that all of the ministers, all of the functionaries, everybody who works for the state in some capacity is now under the tutelage of the central government. But, of course, many people, and especially people in the Catalan television station, have came out immediately and said that they will make it, quote unquote, very difficult for the Spanish central government to exert control over that institution. So in the use of Article 155, which was spelled out on Saturday, Prime Minister Rajoy put in kind of three different steps to each of these kind of appropriations by the government. He said that if people do not abide by his directives, then he will threaten with replacing them or putting them on some kind of leave, and then put new people in place. So I think that it's a kind of a threat on both sides. It's an attempt to get the people who still want to remain in these positions and who maybe do not have such strong feelings for Catalan independence to at least abide by what the government wants to do, or to get people who do have strong feelings about independence out of their position and be placed on, my guess is, what would be indefinite suspension.
Well, look, Becker, you mentioned with this latest move that the prime minister is hoping to sort of separate Catalans with strong feelings about independence from those who maybe feel less strongly and might be willing to go along to keep their jobs. And that all raises the question of how Catalans are responding. Are people pledging to continue to oppose Spain?
I think based on the demonstrations that we saw on Saturday, that many Catalans who didn't vote in favor of independence feel very strongly that the central government should not take over control of Catalonia. They feel that this is an excess. They feel like this is basically eliminating democracy in Catalonia. Remember, the Partido Popular, the conservative party of Mariano Rajoy in Catalonia, is the fifth place party. They have only 8.5% of the vote there. And so effectively what Rajoy has done is has given them a carte blanche, an absolute majority that is uncontested in a region in which they are not very strongly supported at all. So I think Catalans view this as an injustice that is not even representative of Catalan desires, regardless of whether they want independence or not.
And so what are we looking for next? The prime minister says he's taking over Catalonia. There's new solidarity among Catalans. Becker, what's next?
So I think that we could see over the next few days, at least, we could see many manifestations. We could see mass protests like the ones that we saw on Saturday, upwards of 500,000, if not even 1 million, or maybe even 2 million people taking to the streets in Barcelona and elsewhere around Catalonia. But in the medium term, it's unclear. Soraya Sáenz de Santa Maria, the vice president of the government, said that this could, quote unquote, last more than 6 months. Now, presumably, Article 155 does not allow for an unlimited takeover of the Catalan government, but this could be stretched out very far indeed. And why is it being stretched out? Well, I think that it's because the Partido Popular wants to hold elections in Catalonia, but also perhaps is thinking about elections in the rest of Spain, a general election in the spring. And these elections in Catalonia, at least, would take place in January and supposedly reshuffle the deck. And yet the central government has not convincingly showed why it needed to take over these institutions, and perhaps it might even risk the same reassembly of a pro-independence group in Catalonia that would have even more power given their measures and given the popular reaction to their measures.
The government in Madrid tightens the screws on Catalonia after that region goes for independence. Becker Seguin of Johns Hopkins, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
The pre-sentencing trial for Army Sergeant Bo Bergdahl begins today in a military court in Fort Bragg, North Carolina. Last week, Bergdahl pleaded guilty to desertion and misbehavior before the enemy for walking away from his post in Afghanistan in 2009. Rich Oppel is a domestic correspondent for the New York Times, and he's been following the story.
So he walked off his base in 2009. Within hours, he was captured by the Taliban. The military launched a huge search and rescue operation that proved fruitless. He was held in captivity, brutal captivity, for 5 years, and then the Obama administration traded him for five detainees at Guantanamo Bay. He was brought back to the U.S. His parents appeared in a very famous scene in the Rose Garden that later became quite controversial. Republicans objected to the trade and to the extent to which the Obama administration had embraced Bergdahl. Then the next year, he was charged with these two counts, one of which carries a maximum life sentence. You know, and at the preliminary hearing, the Army's own investigating officer actually, you know, recommended no jail time. But the Army proceeded with these charges that could be quite severe, and that's where we are now.
Why did Bergdahl plead guilty?
It's hard to know precisely, but a couple of factors that were clearly at play include a string of defeats that his defense team had suffered in terms of pretrial motions and hearings over the course of the year. These include whether soldiers who the Army says were wounded during the search for him, whether either they can testify or evidence can be presented about their injuries. In addition, whether or not his reenlistment, which occurred while he was in captivity, was legitimate, or whether in reality he should never have been reenlisted and should be a civilian right now. And most importantly, what happened earlier in the year in February when the military judge ruled against the defense's motion to dismiss the charges because of what's known as unlawful command influence, which in this case was the idea that because Donald Trump, who had just been inaugurated in January when the defense made the motion, had been so very outspoken about the case and called for Bergdahl to even be executed.
Well, let's listen to those very words from President Trump.
We're tired of Sergeant Bergdahl, who's a traitor. He's a traitor, a no-good traitor, who should have been executed. Somebody said the other day, well, he had some psychological problems. Well, you know, in the old days, bing, bong, when we were strong, when we were strong.
Bing, bong, the president said, making a gun motion as though Bo Bergdahl should have been shot. He's the commander-in-chief now. Is the defense still trying to argue in sentencing here that the commander-in-chief making remarks about this sergeant in custody are prejudicial?
Well, that's interesting because until last week, it had actually been a settled issue, at least in this courtroom with this judge. It had been a settled issue since his ruling on this in February. But the day Bergdahl pled guilty, Trump was asked in a press conference, well, you know, what about the argument that he can't get a fair trial because of the things you've said? And Trump first said, well, I really can't talk about it. But then he said, you know, words to the effect of, but all of you know what I've said in the past on this.
I'm not going to comment on it, but I think people have heard my comments in the past.
Now, to Bergdahl's defense counsel, this was Trump as president for the first time confirming that his beliefs have not changed and that as president and commander-in-chief, this is how he feels about the case. So they have now made a new motion to the judge, which he might take up this week. It's not clear. But they've made a new motion to the judge saying that, you know, now Trump has said these new comments as commander-in-chief. And so once again, that has prejudiced the case and the case should be thrown out.
What other factors could influence how Bo Bergdahl is sentenced here?
Well, I think the lines are pretty clearly drawn here. The prosecutors are going to argue that the search for Bergdahl in the 6 weeks or so after he was captured really disrupted the war effort and the operational tempo of the military in eastern Afghanistan. But more significantly, they're going to argue that, or it's expected that they will present evidence of wounds suffered by a handful of service members during that search, including one case where a master sergeant was left basically in a wheelchair and unable to speak or care for himself, and in another case where a Navy SEAL had his leg severely wounded and ended his career. On the defense side, I expect them to say a couple of things. One, they're going to talk about the 5 years that Bergdahl spent in captivity and you know, how horrific that was and the price he's already paid for leaving his base. They may bring up arguments they've made in the past about, given Bergdahl's mental health problems, that the Army bears some responsibility here for enlisting him in the first place. And on the soldiers, service members who are wounded, I think they may make the argument, one they've made in the past in court hearings and motions, that one of the missions that led to wounds was badly botched, a military investigation later found. And in the other one where the Navy SEAL was wounded, there was actually perhaps a dual purpose in that, where they were actually trying to get a Taliban insurgent as part of that mission. So in both cases, they've made the case you can't directly tie those wounds to Bergdahl because either in the case of the first mission, the mission was so fatally flawed to begin with, and in the other case, because it really wasn't only about Bergdahl.
And how long before we might know what Bo Bergdahl's sentence is?
Well, that depends on whether the judge rules from the bench or takes it all under advisement, then issues a ruling through a written paper in the next couple of weeks or so. I expect the latter probably, but I could be wrong. I you know, the judge seems like he's someone who likes to move things along pretty quickly.
Rich Oppel, domestic correspondent for The New York Times. Rich, thanks for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Daphne Caruana Galizia was one of Malta's top investigative journalists. She was well known for reports exposing high-level corruption in government, in business, and in criminal enterprises. So when she was murdered in a car bomb explosion outside of her home last week, the list of possible suspects was long. Galizia's death has drawn thousands of mourners and protesters in Malta, and a rare message of condolence from Pope Francis. Crispian Balmer is Reuters chief correspondent in Italy, based in Rome. Crispian, thanks for being here.
A pleasure. Thanks for having me.
I mentioned Daphne Caruana Galizia's long career as an investigative journalist. What was she looking into at the time of her death?
She was an incredibly prolific blogger. You know, she was writing up to 30 posts a day, and her interests and her targets were very wide. She was particularly focused on local politics. She was particularly focused on the Labour government and the Prime Minister, Joseph Muscat, accusing both the government and the Prime Minister of undermining the rule of law in Malta. So anything, any example of abuse of power would go on her blog. She was also attacking the opposition leader. Previously, she'd laid off the opposition party, but suddenly over the last 2-3 months, she turned her fire on them with a lot of very strongly worded attacks, accusing him of, again, abuse of power, of corruption. They've all denied all the charges, and she's been hit by, I think, 36 libel suits in the last 9 months. Besides the politics, she was also going after local businessmen, international figures, basically anyone who she thought was doing something shady on this small Mediterranean island.
So this was the death of a prolific journalist who upset a lot of powerful people, Crispian. And I mentioned that the list of possible suspects was long here. Is there any sense of how many people have not only the potential motive, but the wherewithal to want Daphne Caruana Galizia dead?
It was a very professional hit. She was killed a week ago as she was driving away from her house. A bomb was detonated remotely. Police sources have said they believe that Semtex was used. It's not been used on the island before. The feeling is that it would have been an outsider who carried out the killing. Again, locals cannot believe that their politicians would have ordered such a killing. So people are looking at organized crime. There are a number of shady dealings that have come to the light over the last 2 years. Diesel smuggles working with militias in Libya. The Italian mafia, there have been property developers from abroad. So locals in denial about what's happened, but also feel that there must be some sort of foreign element involved just because of the way that the killing was carried out.
Now, Galizia was also doing reporting stemming from the Panama Papers. These were sprawling revelations detailing offshore entities, financial maneuverings by some very wealthy and powerful people around the world.
She was one of the first people to bring to light the Panama Papers on her island. And she said that a very senior government official and a minister had offshore accounts that they had created as soon as the government was installed and were planning to use those accounts to siphon corrupt money or use money, dirty money, and launder it through the system. She then subsequently said that the Prime Minister's wife had a company in Panama, which she thought was going to be used for the same thing. Now, again, everyone involved in this has denied that there was any wrongdoing involved. The police have not opened a full investigation into her accusations. And therein lies sort of another question that sort of emerged after her death is, you know, why haven't the police investigated these accusations? Malta has had 5 police chiefs in the last 4 years, I think. There's a number of crimes there that have gone unsolved. And the police chief has become a kind of a lightning rod for public fury over what is perceived to be widespread corruption on the island. Again, I've got to stress, people there have all denied the wrongdoing. The top government minister, the chief of staff of the prime minister, they're still in their jobs. So it's very hard to get to the bottom of what's gone on. And this killing is, you know, going to have a very chilling effect on people perhaps thinking in future about revealing alleged corruption on the island.
Investigative journalist Daphne Caruana Galizia murdered in Malta. Crispian Balmer with Reuters in Italy. Thank you.
Thank you.
Opening statements begin today in San Francisco in the shooting death of Catherine Steinle. Steinle was killed July 1st, 2015. The man charged with her murder was an undocumented immigrant with a criminal record who had been deported several times. The death quickly became a rallying point for those opposed to sanctuary cities. The Republican National Convention in the summer of last year featured Steinle's death in a program called Victims of Illegal Immigration. Take a listen to then-candidate Donald Trump talking about it in Phoenix shortly before the election.
Kate Steinle,
gunned down in the sanctuary city of San Francisco by an illegal immigrant deported five previous times, and they knew he was no good.
Marisa Lagos is a politics reporter at KQED in San Francisco, and she's been following the case. Marisa, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Well, remind us who Kate Steinle was and what happened on July 1st, 2015.
Catherine Steinle was a 32-year-old woman. She lived in San Francisco. She had grown up in the East Bay of the San Francisco Bay Area. And she was walking along Pier 14, a waterfront area popular with tourists and locals, arm in arm with her father when suddenly she fell and hit the ground and had been shot by a single bullet. She later died.
How did she come to be shot? Was this an assault?
Well, that's kind of a key part of this trial. Essentially, there was a bullet that exited a gun. It hit the ground before it hit her. And the man charged with murder in this case is a undocumented immigrant who had recently been released from San Francisco jail. He had been homeless for a few months and was, his lawyers say, he was basically sitting on the pier passing time when he noticed something wrapped in some sort of cloth underneath a chair he was sitting in, and that as he unwrapped it, the gun went off. And they claim it's an accident. The prosecutors in the case have charged him with murder.
You're talking about Jose Inez Garcia Zarate. He's being charged with murder in this case. This case has reached the spotlight in America because of Zarate's immigration status and the fact that he committed a crime after being subject to deportation and felony convictions several times.
That's right. This is a man who had reentered the United States multiple times over recent decades. Before he started getting put in federal prison for illegal reentry, he had a handful of relatively minor drug felony charges in various states. He was sort of a drifter from the way his attorneys describe him, basically traveling between Mexico and the United States to find work and a way to feed himself. In this case, he had just finished his third stint in federal prison for illegal reentry. A lot of people may not know this, but if you have a criminal history like he did, you're more likely to get sentenced to prison time if you are caught at the border. And he was caught at the border. He served 5 years in federal prison. And previous to this, when he had gotten out of federal prison, the feds had basically handed him over to Immigration and Customs Enforcement. But in 2015, they did something different. They called San Francisco and asked them if they wanted Garcia Zarate to answer to a 20-year-old marijuana warrant. The sheriff's office said yes because it was a court order and they said they had to obey it. So they went and picked him up. But the marijuana charge was dismissed fairly quickly. He was 20 years old. The evidence had been destroyed. And the sheriff's office then set him free because they are part of a sanctuary city and they have a local law that prohibits them from communicating with or cooperating with Immigration and Customs Enforcement.
So it's easy to see how this case became ground zero for the debate over not only immigration, but sanctuary cities. Opponents of sanctuary cities point to this case and say, this is a man who never should have been in San Francisco in the first place. And if he weren't, then Kate Steinle would still be alive. But what are the attorneys in this case saying? Is this case about immigration at all?
Not according to what the jurors will be hearing. This is District Attorney Spokesman Mac Szabo. He says this is just about getting justice for the Steinle family.
You know, the defendant here is charged with murder. So the issues for us are, you know, whether he pulled the trigger, and if he did so with implied malice.
On the defense side, you know, they agree in the sense that this murder case is not going to be about the broader immigration debate. But defense attorney Mac Gonzalez thinks that the charges brought against him were political and that the DA was moved to sort of throw the book at Garcia Zarate because of his immigration status.
If he was not a Mexican immigrant with prior felony convictions, he would not be charged with this crime.
So here's an entire nation arguing over the issue of immigration, a Justice Department and immigration advocates arguing over sanctuary cities, and a case right at the center of it, which is really just about one person who pulled a trigger and whether that was an accident and whether a ricocheted bullet was aimed at this woman who died.
Yeah, and I mean, I guess as defense attorneys would say, if he even pulled the trigger, they think that this was sort of an accidental firing. I mean, I think it's interesting because this is probably not the best case for opponents of sanctuary cities. This man didn't have a violent past. Again, the federal government had him in their custody and chose to send him to a sanctuary city for reasons that have never really been explained. But yeah, it sparked this national debate. It's really lined people up on on both sides. And it's actually prompted some legislation in Congress named for Catherine Steinle. It's called Kate's Law. And that law seeks to really expand the ability of federal officials to get people to stay in prison longer if they're caught repeatedly entering the U.S. and maybe have a felony history. But I talked to a guy at the Cato Institute, which is a libertarian body, and he studied this really extensively. And he told me, this is David Beer, that he doesn't actually think Kate's Law would have saved Catherine Steinle.
He was clearly not deterred after the first 5-year term or the second. And ultimately, it really played no role in him being sent to San Francisco anyway. So it's not clear to me what this is trying to get at or how the authors believe that this is going to prevent, you know, a future Kate Steinle situation from occurring.
Still, Marisa, we have this case about one murder or alleged murder. The rest of the country is watching this with an immigration agenda in mind.
Yeah, I think that this case is going to be followed very closely, not just by the mainstream media, but by the right-wing media. Fox News really has had this as a priority of theirs since the shooting occurred. And we'll expect to see a lot of attention on this case and continuing forward, of course, on this debate over sanctuary cities and immigration policy in general.
And how long does the judge say the trial may take and how long before we may have a verdict?
You know, I think that the trial itself is expected to last maybe 3 to 4 weeks, and then, you know, it's in the jury's hands, so we'll see. But it won't be, you know, a super long, drawn-out case, but I think there's going to be a lot of interesting questions, including this gun, where it came from. It was actually stolen out of a federal police officer's car, and so there's, I think, some questions about the culpability there.
Marisa Lagos, politics reporter for KQED in San Francisco. Thanks for being here.
Always a pleasure, Todd.
Afra Nasser began working as a reporter in her home country of Yemen in 2008. She wrote about social and cultural issues. Then, after the Arab Spring and uprisings across the Middle East, Nasser was motivated to begin covering press freedom and human rights and corruption. Her articles were censored, so she started a blog that gained global attention and also made her the target of death threats. Nasser now lives in Sweden, where she applied for political asylum and quickly became a citizen. She continues to write about corruption in Yemen, where her family still lives. The Committee to Protect Journalists in New York awarded Nasser their highest honor for press freedom and invited her to a ceremony in the United States next month. But the Trump administration's travel ban restricts travelers from Yemen. And despite her Swedish citizenship, her visa application to visit the U.S. has been denied twice. She returned from the U.S. Embassy today for a third time. Afra Nasser is joining me from a cafe in Stockholm now. Afra Nasser, welcome.
Thank you.
And congratulations on your award from the Committee to Protect Journalists. It's a big honor.
Yeah, thank you. It's humbling. It's like beyond what I ever expected, really.
Well, Afra Nasser, let's talk about whether you're going to be able to come to the United States to collect your honors. You've just returned from the U.S. Embassy there in Stockholm. What news did you get?
I got it. Like, we did it because of, I think, the embarrassment that the U.S. Embassy got into. I think we all did it for the past 2 days on Twitter. I think I was trending thanks to the tweets of the CPJ, the Committee to Protect Journalists, and other people who, you know, tried to show their solidarity with not only me, but all Yemeni journalists and Yemen, you know, in the travel ban or executive order. So, yeah, I'm very happy to announce that we did it. I got it.
Congratulations. Well, that's great news. That means you're going to be able to fly to New York to visit the CPJ and to collect this honor that they've bestowed upon you. What does this moment mean for you, not only getting your visa and getting dispensation to travel here, but being able to showcase your journalism about your home country?
Well, the invitation was not only to attend the ceremony. I was also, you know, asked to travel to the U.S. to participate in several high-level meetings that CPJ organized for me. And that includes, you know, meetings with the big media outlets and also the State Department office in D.C. and also universities and be at public speaking venues and etc. So it's not only to get the ceremony, but also to try to inform and influence the public opinion in the U.S. to understand about the situation in Yemen, what my Yemeni fellows are going undergoing, and also, as you know, the whole nation is undergoing through the ongoing war. So I was very happy that I was able to get the visa first, not only to be part of the, you know, the ceremony, but also for me to understand that media has such a role in making a change and making a difference for me, and hopefully to push for peace in Yemen as well.
Well, let's talk about the situation in Yemen that you mentioned and that you've been reporting on. We've been talking a lot on this program about Yemen lately, the dire need in hospitals and medical clinics across the country, the famine, and of course the war. What's the situation there now?
The situation is very, very dire. It's beyond the words that I can use, actually. So you have today the biggest or the largest humanitarian crisis in the world. Not in Syria, not in Myanmar. It's right in Yemen, surrounded by some of the world's richest countries who are part of Saudi-led coalition bombing them. And at the same time, you have internal battles on the ground where civil war started since, mid-2014. And all of these level conflicts have really drained out the country that was already regarded as the poorest Arab country for many decades. Today, people are without medicine, without food, without shelter, without nothing. They're barely surviving. The cholera outbreak by a lot of UN bodies is expected to hit or to impact about 1 million human beings in Yemen. And that's like, you know, the largest number recorded in history. So the only outcome of this, you know, magnitude or the big scale of this kind of humanitarian crisis is that it should bring a lot of the world's attention to Yemen, and also to start any form of political process that could help in negotiation process or peace talks and start resolving the conflict.
Afra, you've also reported on government corruption and women's issues and human rights. Why did it become impossible for you to report on these issues and stay in your home country? Why did you have to flee to Sweden?
For me, Sweden is a coincidence. I just happened to be in Sweden at that time of the beginning of the uprising in 2011. I came to Sweden just to study, and one thing led to another, and I didn't have any kind of, you know, plan where to go. I just found myself in Sweden, and that was the right thing to do at that time, as the violence escalated in my home country. And also I was already getting a lot of death threats and pressure from family and friends to stop writing. So it's just a coincidence that I happened to be here and I had to seek asylum.
Well, let me ask you about those death threats and that pressure from your family, which is understandable. You've written to your critics that you won't be silenced. Why is that so important to you?
I think freedom of expression is the basic element that any community should have to bring a change. Without expressing oneself, without expressing that change, we would never be able to make the change. So, like, freedom of expression for me is not just, you know, a luxury. It's like food and water. So that's why I wrote it back in 2011. And even till today, I still, believe in what I said. And I think any achievement that I've done all over these years is that I still live up to that principle, despite all the obstacles.
Afra Nasser, we are so happy that you're going to be able to come to the United States to speak to Americans and to collect your honors from the Committee to Protect Journalists because of your work in Yemen. So congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you.
But it feels good, doesn't it?
It is. It's like my biggest dream in journalism was to create a magazine. I never really dreamt of, getting that award. So it feels it's fantastic, really.
Yemeni journalist Afra Nasser on her way to New York to collect her honors. Afra, it's a pleasure.
Thank you.
Well, it's time for us to go, but we wanted to leave you today with an update on a story that we covered on Friday. We told you about the case of Jane Doe, a 17-year-old undocumented teenager who's 15 weeks pregnant. Jane Doe was seized at the border by immigration authorities, and she's in the custody of Health and Human Services, which has denied her request for an abortion. Before a three-judge panel on the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, government lawyers argued they're not taking a position on whether Jane Doe, as an undocumented person, has the right to an abortion. But since she's in government custody, HHS says they won't help her have the abortion.
The government is not preventing, blocking, or imposing any obstacle on Ms. Doe's pursuit of an abortion here, such that it could constitute an undue burden within the meaning of Casey. The government has not put any obstacle in her path. Rather, the government is refusing to facilitate an abortion.
In a 2-1 ruling, that court sided with the Trump administration and gave the government until the end of the month to secure a sponsor for Jane Doe. We're going to continue to follow this story and the legal precedents that it might set for the rights of undocumented people. And that's our show for today. I'm headed to Texas later, and we'll talk to you tomorrow from KERA Public Radio in Dallas. In the meantime, thanks so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.